You're listening to Revenue Vitals with Chris Walker.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to RevSpot. We're really excited to have one of our next special guests. And I just am going to throw out a quick shout out to their background and their studio because it's super rad and I love it. And if you guys aren't watching this, if you're listening, go take a peek. It's pretty rad. But without further ado, why don't you just go ahead and introduce yourself and listeners would love to hear it.
Tanner, thanks for having me. Thanks for the shout out on the studio. Hey, everyone. My name's Chris Walker. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm very deep in the B2B sales and marketing and data RevOps type of space. I own three different companies. I own a part of a content production agency, part of a demand gen agency, and also a software startup called Passetto. I've been coming to this podcast studio for like the past 3 or 4 months. Up until that, I had a home studio. I changed my third bedroom into a studio. And I've moved to a professional studio in 2024. And damn, it's been a game changer for me in terms of being able to format the content in the right way. Now we have all the stuff ready for like a great TikTok shot or a vertical short form that we didn't have before. Still works for the LinkedIn, which is one or slightly vertical. And then you get all the stuff for YouTube and podcasts as well. And yeah, so it's been a great transition. And so for people that take their content really seriously and are able to derive business results out of it, I think it's a pretty great investment, or at least it's been that way for me.
Yeah, 100%. And for all of your businesses, not just one, I'm assuming.
Precisely, yeah.
Yeah, right on, man. Well, cool. Chris, I'm really excited to jump into this. And I want to dive in a little bit more on all three of the businesses for you. Is there any particular one where you're like, yes, this was the one that kind of started it all? Or I'm really curious to know, just kind of off the cuff question, is this, which one for you is kind of the home hitter, or is there none of them? Are they all different?
Well, my first company that I started was Refine Labs in 2019. It was actually my third company, but it was my first company that was actually like successful and moved on. And I think talking about the losses that I had in my other two in 2013, 2014, and then again, 2015 to 2017, where I got some revenue, I generated some profit. It was a nice side hustle, but it never became a material thing that I did full time. I always had another job. And then being able to, with that experience and those sort of quote unquote like failures, be able to start my company in 2019, Refine Labs, that was like the starting point of me as a true entrepreneur, where I wasn't working a job and being an entrepreneur on the side. So that was the first one. And I was the founder and CEO of that company for the first 5 years, and recently promoted my business partner, Megan Bowen, to CEO. As I've moved to work on a software company. And I believe that this change has already been and has already demonstrated, both for me personally, for Megan personally, but also for our customers and for our team and for a lot of those things. I think that the change has been really strong and it's been a cool evolution for me. But Refine Labs was definitely the first one. And I think it's interesting because as I came up as a founder and CEO, that also used like a personal brand to be able to drive a lot of like business and awareness and growth that initially my personal brand got so tied into my agency Refine Labs that it sort of closed me off to other opportunities like sponsorships and collaborations and other things like that. And since I've been able to sort of move out of just that and own multiple businesses, it's created a lot of new partnership opportunities and new sponsorships and things like that. And it was a learning lesson for me and anyone that like has a substantial personal brand, that your personal brand should not be fully attached to your company. Your personal podcast should not be the company's podcast. Your live events and sponsorships and partnerships should not be entirely dependent on the company that you currently work for. And when you're able to create that separation, one, you realize that you're under monetizing your personal brand, but also it opens you up to a ton of other opportunities, investment opportunities, partnerships, and a lot of the other things that I've started to explore, which have been like major unlocks and stair steps up for me professionally.
Yeah. So you're saying the brand that you've created yourself has been able to help you not just with Refine Labs, but with the other companies that you've started and those kind of pieces that you're saying?
Yeah, 100%. And it creates opportunities. There's a thing that I've learned relatively recently that was big for me, that there's a difference between being an owner and being an executive. There's also a difference between a personal brand and a company brand. And being able to create separation both in your mind and ideally like financially and things like that, I think create a lot of benefits and open you up to a lot more opportunities, which is for a small group of people that have been able to do. Look at Mr. Beast, for instance. He's involved in so many entrepreneurial endeavors and businesses. The brand is the halo that then sits under all these different businesses. If you look at athletes, they're not all in on one brand typically. They have brand sponsorships in a ton of different categories and things like that. And oftentimes I see founders or thought leaders get so attached to one company that it starts to become synonymous and it almost blocks you from a lot of potential opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think that's super true. So let's dive into Refine Labs a little bit with what you've been able to learn. What did you take from those quote unquote failures? I like that because with every entrepreneur, it's very much not a failure unless you give up. And so tell me a little bit about creating Refine Labs and where did that come from what you learned?
Yeah. So first off, the distinction between micro failures and macro failures. The only failures that are not acceptable are when you put your, as an entrepreneur, is when you put yourself out of business. And to recognize that there are a lot of micro failures where maybe your revenue is going to go backwards for 6 months, or maybe you're going to make the wrong investment in a product and the product's not going to materialize and you're going to waste $600,000 in development and not get any type of return on that. There are micro failures that happen in an entrepreneurial journey, which are part of the process. When you are the leader, the CEO, the person that needs to see the vision and make those decisions, you must know that not every decision you make is going to be the correct one. And it's very different for all the other people in the company that don't have to make those types of decisions, but are going to judge you around the decisions that you make, that you never truly understand until you're actually the person that has to make the decisions and make bold moves and place bets and things like that, and then be able to deal with the ramifications and the consequences of some things working out incredibly and playing out so well, and other things not working out. And it's just part of the process. And so I started Refine Labs just because I saw inside of real life as an employee that B2B companies didn't realize that marketing was the biggest issue in their go-to-market in their company. That they thought that they needed more salespeople or to hire a sales trainer or to find a better sales leader or to buy more technology to automate their SDRs or all this other stuff that they tried, when in reality, it was because the market doesn't know who you are, doesn't care about your product, and it makes it way harder to for your sales team to sell stuff. And so on that core sort of easy insight recognition, if you were in the work doing it that most other people didn't see, I started my company, led this wave of thinking not about marketing as a lead gen and sales enablement function only, but marketing as a core function inside of the organization that drives, creates demand and drives revenue for your company. And now 5 years later, a lot of people see that as commonly accepted and best practice. But I'll tell you, in 2017, 18, 19, this was not best practice. Executives did not think this way. They didn't have the awareness to it. And so that was sort of the impetus of me starting my company and the entrepreneurial journey. And there's a lot of things that worked out really well and I look like a genius for. And there's other things that I made decisions on that turned out to not be the right decision or turned out to be the right decision made at the wrong time that didn't play out the way that I had hoped. And to me, that's just part of being the CEO, just like as an athlete or a star player.
Yeah, 100%.
Tom Brady lost, I think, 5 Super Bowls, but he's also the greatest player of all time. Kobe Bryant missed tens of thousands of shots. Still one of the greatest players of all time. And I think that as business people, we think that we need to have perfection or we strive for perfection when in every other creative or endeavor that we look at and we respect the people that do it, there's so many failures that happen. It's so not perfection. I mean, I think being able to bring that type of mindset into business is something that I think would help a lot of people, specifically entrepreneurs, because perfection is just disguised for insecurity. And perfection is just disguise for not wanting to be wrong or be judged by people who are on the sidelines judging the decisions and things that you're doing. And that's why people pretend it's perfection, but it's really just they don't want to make a decision because they're scared of what people are going to say or think about them. As entrepreneurs that really do it know that not every decision you make is going to be perfect, that not everything that you plan is going to work out how you did, but it's part of the process.
Totally. Do you think with that, do you think the decision-making process gets better over time, despite the fact that you make, everybody makes bad decisions and it's kind of just inevitable, but what do you think about the error rate, the delta? What do you think about that there?
there's an interesting sort of concept called the ignorance tax. As an entrepreneur, as you sort of make decisions that turn out to be wrong and you feel a pain and you learn a lesson, that you're paying down your ignorance tax. And then over time, you've learned those lessons so that when you have to make that decision again, or where you see a situation that's parallel, you know how to make that decision. And I buy into that a lot. If you think about your career, your professional career as an entrepreneur, and you realize that you could play this game if you wanted to for 50 years, from 20 to 30 to 70 to 80, if you wanted to, right? Some people want to retire at 55 and like call it a day, but many people that are entrepreneurs are hungry. They want to keep playing. They like doing it. So when you look at that over a significant time scale and realize that I'm 12 years into my career and I'm like technically probably around 12 years into like trying entrepreneurship, that I've made two macro failures where the company that I started didn't work out. One was a cash flow and inventory issue. I just didn't have the cash to make an inventory buy for my Shopify and Amazon store. I didn't have 50 grand to give to the manufacturer to then have it sit on a boat and wait 6 or 9 months to actually sell the product. And the company just couldn't make the inventory buy and basically dissolved. And another core, in hindsight, a mistake that I made that makes a lot of sense in hindsight, was trying to build a software company and an agency in the same company was a very large mistake on my part. It's something that you don't learn that lesson as an entrepreneur until you actually do it. And I advise and talk to tons of people that run a professional services company, and they think that the holy grail is to build a technology and then change their professional services company into a technology company so they can get a multiple on revenue instead of a multiple on EBITDA. And the reality is that 99% of the companies that go through that process end up hurting their existing business in pursuit of building a new business. And the real solution that I've learned over making the mistake for myself is that the business that you have today, you should focus on continuing to deliver tangible, measurable value in the thing that you offer to customers, especially if it's a substantial business. And if you want to start a tech business, if you want to build a software company, if you want to do that, then get it out of that company and build it on the side and have the right leaders and the right attention and the right investment in order for that to be successful. And do not blend them together in hopes of transforming your professional services company into a tech company. Because if you read the business books, if you look at people that have done it, like 99% of companies that go on that endeavor fail. And my attempt at that was also a failure. And the probability and the statistics would indicate that it would be likely to be a quote unquote, it was a micro failure. I didn't put ourselves out of business. Yeah, that was another core like lesson learning for me.
What was that services business?
Refine Labs.
So that was Refine Labs as well.
And then we started to build an education product called The Vault. And then we started to build a software product that is now moved out, different technology, different people, is now Paceto. But at first, I was convinced that what the market actually needed was one vendor that did your analytics, did your strategy consultant, did your media execution, did your content. And just like in a B2C company where they hire an AOR and they pay that agency of record to do all the stuff that they need, and they pay them millions of dollars a year to make television commercials and digital advertising and social media content and consulting on strategy and running analytics reports and getting consumer insights, that B2B companies would model and do the same thing that B2C companies have done for decades. And the reality is that that core assumption that I made in terms of how we grow and scale our business was wrong, that B2B companies don't do that. They'd rather pay 8 different vendors $10,000 a month than one vendor $60,000 a month, even though the one vendor at $60,000 a month is one more cost effective and also more aligned and more consolidated and delivers a better product. But they don't think about it that way. The CFO's in the office saying, oh, all these people are $10,000, that makes sense. But then you put one big vendor in, and they're like, oh my God, this is $60,000 a month. We have to be scrutinizing this expense every 30 days. When in reality, they spend more money on all the other vendors and don't scrutinize it in the same way. I think in business and entrepreneurship, there are oftentimes unrecognized assumptions that we make about how we devise our strategy and how we grow our company that lead us to making some, in hindsight, poor decisions. And being able to identify those unnamed assumptions, like that one specifically, that B2B companies want to have an AOR model like B2C companies, that wasn't a conscious thought to me. That wasn't something that was part of our strategy, but it drove a lot of the decisions that we made subconsciously. So that was a pretty interesting learning for me. And as you peel back the layer, like some of the things that I'm talking about, most people will never experience. But being able to learn from some of the things, even if it helps you in your role that isn't in entrepreneurship, I think is super interesting.
With Refined Labs now, when you're helping people get this, these different services off the ground, and you're going to these companies and you provide some of this software, and then if you guys need to, if you want to put it in, you're like, hey, we've got this Paseto, and then you've got the Vault. Is that kind of what you do now, is just almost use it as like an option or like a third party service?
No, these two companies are entirely independent.
So they don't even talk to each other, really.
They're not used in concert all the time, and it's not required to be used that way. And there's some overlap in our customer base, but over time, we believe that it's best that both companies can make the right strategic decisions for their own business rather than mixing them together. What Refine Labs typically does is help companies that deploy hundreds of thousands, millions, or tens of millions of dollars a year on digital advertising in a strategy that is commensurate with a 2015 to 2017 marketing and digital advertising strategy that isn't delivering ROI. We help companies identify and re-architect that entire strategy, tactically implementing it inside of those platforms, proving it out, teaching their team how to think about it, rethinking the analytics around it, and helping the companies get dramatically better results in terms of their marketing and advertising investments. And it makes a massive difference for big companies to spend a lot of money on ads. So that's a core problem that we help solve over there. At Paseto, we're much more focused on the entire go-to-market and the analytics and performance around that, specifically around signal-based selling and signal-based measurement, which I know HubSpot's done some interesting work on, so maybe we can jam on that in a little bit. But that companies will consistently measure, okay, what type of account is this? They'll measure the fit. What's the segment? What's the vertical? What's the revenue range? They have all this data to enrich it. Then they'll also look at the persona and the job title and how long they've been there. And they're trying to do all this stuff to optimize for what is the right fit of account. But they don't collect enough data around what intent signals are these accounts and the people inside of those accounts sending us, and which of these signals actually matter when it comes to pipeline and conversion to revenue. And that's what we're focused on at Paseto, is connecting the dots between fit and intent to be able to create, this is the signals that our accounts send us where we win at a high sales velocity all the time. In this segment, this is what happens. In this segment, in this geography, this is what happens, which then are able to help you drive what investments that you make to actually create those signals. If you think about marketing investments, most marketing dollars are spent to spend money and create a signal that sales could follow up with. An ebook, spend money on an ad, get an ebook download, try to get a demo request on content syndication, try to get a click on an automated email, or try to get a click on a banner ad. All that money is deployed to create a signal, which then gives our sales team a reason or an option to reach out. And we need to have much more granularity and much more scrutiny over how we spend the money, what signals we create, and what the productivity around those signals are for sales and sales velocity.
Yeah, that's basically the way that most companies ought to go if they're not going, but a lot of companies are, just that data, gathering the data of like, hey, how interested are these people actually? And then defining all of those actions, defining everything that they're doing, like you said, with the clicks to the opens to the downloads, all of these things.
So much data. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much data. And like, what combination of all this data really makes a difference? That's really hard to do. But with Paseto, it seems like it makes it way better, way easier. So that's cool.
It's an entirely new dimension of your data to think about tracking signals.
Dimension is a good word. It feels like the fourth dimension.
Every company sets up their process to track a lead, a person that moves through a process, but not recognizing that if you have a contact at a target account, that they're going to send you a lot of different signals. You're going to take a lot of different sales actions on those signals, and you do not have an infrastructure to track it because it's built for one linear journey. And so that's a core insight that companies will track their leads, they'll track their accounts, they have some data on an opportunity object, but all the stuff that happens before an opportunity is created, where people are moving, sending you signals and moving through processes that are not being tracked and that are not being connected to actual like pipeline and revenue. And it becomes a huge gap, because if you look at different signals, an easy example in terms of signals is that somebody could come to your website through organic search or direct traffic and ask for a demo, and they're a qualified account, and you'll win those at 5 to 12%, depending on how good you are at it. You could get that exact same person and that exact same account that you use a LinkedIn ad to have them download your ebook And then sales will take action on that, and you'll win 1 out of 1,000 to 1 out of 5,000 of those sales actions. Same account, same person in the account, entirely different signal. And recognizing that as a sales leader, as an SDR leader, as a marketing leader that deploys investments to deploy investments, that we need to be tracking these signals to be able to make the right decisions around how we spend our sales team's time, how many resources we have, what types of resources, what activities they do, and why they're doing those activities. It just creates a whole nother dimension of data. Do you still need to track leads? Yes. Do you still want to have data on your accounts? Yes. It's just adding another layer that makes certain decisions in your marketing and your go-to-market engine incredibly easy when you have it.
Yeah, it's incredibly easy. So kind of jumping back to now HubSpot and Refine Labs, you know, I know you guys do a lot of work with Salesforce, with HubSpot. I'm curious to know your thoughts on how the marketing engine works within the companies you help set up with HubSpot and at Refine Labs. What does that kind of look like for you guys when you walk through a company? Tell me a little bit more about that journey.
Yeah, in terms of like customer demographics and profile, I would say a majority of our customers use Salesforce CRM as the core sales CRM, and then we'll use HubSpot for marketing automation and marketing CRM, or Marketo, and then you got a handful that use Pardot that got into some long-term contract, but that's sort of phasing out. And you get some customers that use Oracle, or they use HubSpot as the core CRM. They tend to be a little bit smaller in terms of size and maturity. But generally, the mix is like HubSpot, Salesforce, Marketo. And regardless of sort of which tools that you use and how you do them, our belief is that inside of your CRM, you should have all the core data that you need to make decisions, not exporting data out of HubSpot or Salesforce and then manipulating it inside of business intelligence tool, or manipulating it inside of Excel and running a pivot table to try and get insights off of that, because it's not repeatable. And then oftentimes people are looking at the wrong data. We basically have set, here are all the things that we should be tracking, and here's the properties, here's the data types, here's how it should be collected, whether automatic or manually. We've defined all of those things. In HubSpot, it's a little bit different than Salesforce. In Salesforce, we deploy a Salesforce app that actually does that stuff. In HubSpot, we haven't fully supported it yet, but expect that it'll either be a similar app, or that HubSpot will actually be able to do it natively with some, you know, DIY customization and instruction. We'll see. But the core thing is finding quick wins in the data that already exists, and then auditing and analyzing the data that exists right now, and putting together a plan so that in the future we have all the data that we need to make smart, easy, fast decisions. I mean, that's sort of like the initial steps. And we're working with like mature, you know what I mean? It's different than like going out and doing a HubSpot implementation project with an early stage company. That's really not our involvement in there. These companies have many marketing ops and revenue operations resources. Typically, they have a lot of technology, and they really need help on what do we collect and why, not necessarily can you do the work for us. Like, they have smart, talented people that can do the work, just need advice on where are the gaps and what, where do we go from here.
Yeah, they're really probably wanting to just take it a little bit more to the next level in their own business of like, hey, how do we actually make this more successful without changing much? Just what data do we need to look at? And then we can make decisions from there. That's kind of what you're saying, right? For the companies you work with.
The implementations are not that technically challenging. It's not about that. It's about knowing where you're missing and what to do. And I think that often in-house operations people just do not, and this isn't a knock to them, it's just the where they sit in the whole ecosystem does not give them a broad view about where the market is going and what's working and what's not, and where are the gaps and what are the best practices. It just doesn't get there. And a lot of the mature companies get their advice from analyst firms and consulting firms that do not implement the solution. So they get top level advice of, here's a pretty picture about how you run your go-to-market. Let's have a executive offsite and go through it and rah-rah, get everyone going. And then right when it gets to implementation with the ops team, they have to interpret what does this actually mean, and then make assumptions and guesses around how do we put this inside of Salesforce. And then you're reinventing the wheel in ops, and the pretty picture and the model that was put together breaks down in practice. And I think the companies that build the models and do the consulting must also have an idea of how you do the implementation, because passing the baton from an analyst firm, serious decisions, all to some ops firm hoping they can figure it out, or passing it to some in-house ops team hoping that they can figure it out, has generally just led to inconsistent data across companies, poor implementations, things that should take a month, take 9 months to get done in some companies. And I think it's just this disconnect between theory and practice.
Yeah, that's so true. There's so much of that going on in the C-suite level, I feel like, in businesses, 100%. Chris, this has been fun work. We're actually coming up pretty close to the end here. And I just want to spend a little bit of time doing a few rapid-fire questions and get your thoughts. Are you ready?
Love it. Let's go.
Okay, sweet. All right, first question. What is a HubSpot, or in your guys' case, I know you guys use a CRM hack or feature that you think is underutilized in the market?
I think that most companies try to copy data from the leader contact onto the opportunity, and they use the opportunity as the main way that they report. And I think that there's a lot of flaws in that. And I think that leveraging, like I think HubSpot released a lead object that facilitates multiple journeys based on the signal natively. I got to explore that more, but I think that's where you're going, which I think is really smart. And then in Salesforce, using a custom object, which is effectively what you're doing as well, but natively, to be able to track all of the signals and then pair that data with lead and contact data, account data, and opportunity data. I think that is the future and current like hack in terms of having the right data and process to close a lot of the gaps that we have in go-to-market today.
Okay, yeah. So essentially just creating a bunch of different lead parts for one specific content.
You have a lead object, and you have an account object, and you have an opportunity object. You need a signal object that's tracking all the signals and then attaching that to the outcomes of the signals based on ARR and pipeline and revenue and account data and person data. And I think that ends up being the hack that's why it's an entirely new dimension. It's an entirely new dimension that's not standard it's not a standard object inside of CRMs right now.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. Okay, next question. Besides ChatGPT, a RevOps or AI tool that you can't live without in your average day?
I don't think there are many. I don't, yeah. So I use Hatch for content production. I'm also an investor and shareholder in that company. It's a huge hack for me because my content provides so much impact in terms of revenue and awareness and financial outcomes for such an insignificant cost in terms of actually producing the videos and things like that. So I think that's actually my number one quote unquote hack. When it comes to the tools, my position recently has changed or evolved to the fact that the main tool that companies underutilize is their CRM. And so it's not about buying a new tool or getting some AI bot to run through your CRM or write data there, that like the core data in the CRM, the foundation is off. And then all the peripheral tools are then pushing data in and pulling data out of a bad foundation of data. And I think that as we continue to have like large tech stacks and integrated tools and that type of stuff, that the core data foundation ends up becoming a huge liability for companies if not put in the right place.
Okay, two more questions. Next one is, if you had a magic wand to change one thing in your business or businesses, whichever one you want to choose, what would it be?
The beauty about being like a CEO and an entrepreneur is that you actually do have the magic wand and your business can be whatever you want it to be. So I never think about, oh, I wish I could change this thing. I love that my current company has 3 people and we're bootstrapped and we only have $110,000 in our bank account. I love that. It leads to smart decisions, fast action, you're back against the wall, being customer focused, finding the problem, moving quickly. A lot of people see not having a lot of money or not having a big team as a disadvantage. I've actually found it to be a huge advantage that big companies that have a lot of people have communication layers and they move slower and there's more politics, it's more bureaucratic and they're not as customer centric. And so in that way, I see it as an advantage in my business. Now, something that I did at Refine Labs that I think I'm going to do differently at Paseto, and it was just a different time in my career, it was a different time in the world. It was just different. But I've been really on to this concept of like chill work from Rand Fishkin that we're taught as entrepreneurs and as tech executives or even people in the tech industry, that what you're supposed to do is work 70, 80 hours a week and grind it out even though you're unhappy and have it impact or like not pay attention to other parts of your life because you're so focused on like this thing. When in reality, a lot of people, I would argue that I'm more productive at 30 hours a week than I am at 80. And so not having such a pressure on myself and my team to exude that type of force and make those types of sacrifices at this point in my life, I just don't need to anymore. And I'd be far more comfortable building a business, to a software company, to $5 or $10 million with no investors on the cap table, and it taking 7 years, and our team being small, and us actually liking the work and the companies we work for and things like that, than trying to build a $100 million hyper growth company where you like kill yourself to try and get there and the odds are very low. I just have a whole different perspective on business and how it integrates with the rest of your life. And that's something I'm not waving a magic wand wishing about it. I've recognized that it's important to me, and I'm implementing those types of things in the companies that I run and am involved with.
Yeah, well, that's really cool. Even if you're not more productive at from 30 hours to 80 hours, you're pretty close to like those extra 50 hours don't really make that much of a difference, honestly.
Sometimes it's a negative impact because hour 71 of the week, you have to make a decision. You make a bad decision.
Yeah, 100%.
And so as leaders and entrepreneurs, what I've learned is it's more about making a small focused amount of measured, smart decisions, knowing that some of them are going to be not correct, but we need to learn that thing and make an adjustment and move. And that a lot of the other time supports doing work and tasks that don't actually move the needle.
Mm, yeah, that's cool.
To me now, it's easier to just say those five things don't move the needle. Let's not waste all our time on them. Here are the five things that matter. You own these two. I own these two. Third co-founder, you own that one. Let's stay focused. Let's do our stuff. And we know what we need to do. And anything else that's in the peripheral, if it's a fire, an emergency customer, yeah, some things are going to come up, but we're not going to get sidetracked on all these side projects that are most likely not going to move the needle just in the sake of like grinding it out.
Yeah, I love that. Great thought. Okay, last question, Chris. If you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I've trained my brain over the past 5 years to not look at my life or the world this way, that I'm happy about everything that happened to me and the order that it happened and when it happened for me, and that certain things that happened that were like bad or where I made a failure or where something in a short period of time, like me being asked to resign, feel like a bad thing, ended up actually being the best things for me. And so from a mindset perspective, I don't really think about it this way, but I think that having people close to you that have done it before, that can coach you in some of the things that are really important, where you trust them and you follow them. I've had a couple of people that have come into my life at certain times and been just what I needed in terms of like telling me something that I needed to hear from somebody that I would actually intake it and listen to. Putting yourself in a position where those people are around you in your sphere to be able to help and guide you, especially as an entrepreneur, or as an executive scaling a company. I think that having the right people around you to help you see the things that might be hard for you to see because you're so in it, I think that's a huge piece of advice that I would encourage a lot of people at all facets of their journey to think about.
Totally. Yeah. Get somebody who's done it before. So good. So good. Okay, Chris, this has been really fun. How can people go find you and connect with you?
Awesome. Yeah. Appreciate you all. If you got to this point, appreciate you listening to the episode. If you want to learn more about what I talk about entrepreneurship and marketing strategy and revenue operations and even sales development and sales processes a lot. So all over that spectrum, I host the B2B Revenue Vitals podcast. You can check that out on Spotify or Apple, as well as I post content on LinkedIn and other experimental channels like TikTok and YouTube Shorts and YouTube Long Form. And so feel free to find me on any of those channels, ChrisWalker171. If you like the episode, you got some thoughts on it, you have some questions, feel free to shoot me a DM. The best way to reach me on DM is on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Love it. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show, dude. That was really fun. I had a ton of stuff that I learned from you. I'm really excited to dive in again and see what we got.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks about all the listeners. Thank you so much. It was super fun.